This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Olive Podcast. I'm Janine, Olive's deputy editor and podcast host, and each week I'll be catching up with fascinating characters from the food world as they share stories, advice, and expertise. I'm delighted to welcome Angela Klussen to the podcast. Angela is an award-winning food writer, cook, and presenter. She's the author of three books, The Vinegar Cupboard, Borough Market, The Knowledge, and her latest seasoning, How to Cook and Celebrate the Seasons, which we'll be taking a deep dive in today. Welcome, Angela.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
Thank you for coming and congratulations on the book. It's absolutely beautiful and we're lucky enough to be able to run some recipes in the March issue of Olive, which is out now. I know you haven't seen it, but I'm going to go and get you a copy.
I almost want to, like, can we stop the chat and just, like, go and get the magazine, please?
I've been looking through the book today and it is, as I said, beautiful. Can you tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind writing it?
Yeah, it came about really because it's very much how I cook. And I hadn't really thought about what is my kind of non-professional cooking life. And then someone asked me, you know, what is your approach at home to food? And I really kind of stopped and thought about it. And it came to me that I get so much joy out of really feeling the rhythm of the seasons through my kitchen. And that kind of stuck in my head that is fundamentally how I live and cook and eat. But then in honesty, I also realised I think probably like most of us on a day-to-day basis, get stuck a little bit in the culinary rut. Mm. Do the same thing with the same produce, use the same flavour partners. And when I wanted inspiration, I have too many cookbooks I can reach to and go for. But I thought, God, wouldn't it be great if there was a place where there were lots of inspiration and ideas for ways you could just keep on thinking, oh, I could try that, and keep on not getting bored with produce right through the length of the season. So I decided to write it, and that kind of how seasoning came about, a sort of feeling I could do with this book, and so maybe other people could too. And the other thing that kind of factored into it was that I realised I was getting probably a little bit cross with people not, or rather people buying things that are out of season.
Mm.
And, you know, the thing, you know, strawberries at Christmas and tomatoes and all those things. And then why are we drawn to doing this? And maybe, again, it is slight boredom and not knowing really how we can keep on using
the same thing, like, over and over again,
yeah,
as we said.
So I was trying to kind of, that's very much the heart of the book.
Yeah, I love that. Can we talk a little bit about why, although having everything available all the time could seem like a good thing, and it is a good thing for various reasons, it's also quite problematic.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult one because we have become so used to having what we want, you know, when we want it, and that's how modern life kind of rolls. Mm-hmm. But it does create a problem for food, and a lot of that problem is around energy. So if you think about growing things out of season, you need so much artificial light and heat to do that, to make them grow. And then you can store them for a long length of time. So again, loads of energy being used in that. The chances are these things are being grown quite a long way from where they're being bought and consumed. All those transportation energy as well. So there's a huge kind of factor of that sustainability issue about having things out of their natural season. And when things are having to be transported a long distance, they tend not to be harvested when they're ripe. They're harvested before then and they are allowed to ripen over that time. But that's artificial ripening, which is quite a long way away from what would happen naturally on the vine or on a tree. So it's a double-edged thing. It's very much an environmental thing, but it's really also to do with flavour.
Yeah, completely. Another thing I wanted to touch on is we seem to be having a very mild and wet. It's pouring down today, February this year. Could we talk a little bit about seasonal shifts and the implications of that?
Yeah, the book begins with a couple of features about why eating seasonally matters. And one of them is a piece called Shifting Seasons, because as you just said, Ginny and I, our seasons are shifting. And again, as you just say, we are talking kind of mid, late Feb. Last weekend, we had 15 degrees here in London.
It's crazy.
That's more typically the average for April. You know, that's something we really kind of have to take note of. Traditional seasons, think of winter, kind of December, February, spring from kind of mid-March to May, summer, June to August, autumn, September, October, November. But what's happening with climate change is that our winters are getting shorter, they're getting milder, summers are longer and hotter, springs and autumns are shorter. And all of that has such an impact on how we grow our produce and the land. And one of the big problems is this idea of the early springs, the kind of fake springs, if you like, which is what, I was so worried about last weekend, and I was saying it on my socials, because the plants, it's a bit like us. Like, we all get a bit of warmth in February. I think, hello.
T-shirt weather.
I can ditch the coat, suddenly can sit outside the glass or something maybe, It starts to feel different. We get ahead of ourselves thinking it's spring. Mm. Well, so do the plants. They get a little bit ahead of themselves thinking, oh, it's spring now. This is what we need to do. But very often that spell of warmth is followed by some frost. And that is then damaging these plants, which have started to kind of get to blossom or to get a little bit more further into the advancement of their growing cycle. Yeah. So then the plants get damaged and then that has a huge impact on the eventual crops.
Yeah, because you had a statistic, didn't you, about, I think it was apple farmers?
Yeah, and it's apples and onions and carrots.
And they get stung quite a lot, don't they?
Yeah, it does. It really happens a lot. And then as well as the crop damage, the effect of having milder winters is that pests can survive a little bit better. So again, that's a factor in crops being damaged. It really is a problem that our conventional seasons are shifting, and nature has a lot to cope with in order to still make the food that we need.
Yeah. I think people can get overwhelmed as well, thinking that they can't really make a difference. So they just sort of stick their head in the sand and think, just forget about it. Yeah. There's nothing I can do. But you think people can make positive choices, don't you?
Definitely, we can all make positive choices. Oh my goodness, we've got to hold on to that, haven't we? We can all make positive choices that can make a difference. And I think in this context, it is astonishingly simple, because the vegetables and fruits with the lowest greenhouse emissions are simply the ones that are grown in season locally. Because everything that I said a few minutes ago about all the artificial heat and light that's needed to grow things out of season, get it in season, you've knocked those out. Everything I said about having to transport things a long way because they've been grown somewhere else, if they're local, you can knock that out. So these are very, very simple choices. Obviously, not everybody has choice, but when you do have choice, that I feel does come with a responsibility to wield that choice well. Yeah. And we can.
Yeah, for sure. It's not like the things that are shipped in are often cheaper, because your apples that are grown here or your vegetables that are grown here in season will naturally be cheaper because they haven't had to, shore up the transport costs and stuff. So it's just a case of, as always, we say this a lot on the podcast, it needs us to get involved and start reading those labels a bit more carefully or asking when we go into, yeah, you know, butchers or fishmongers or...
And re-familiarising ourselves with what is in season.
Yeah.
When. And because I think, you know, things can get a little bit confused about what is what and when is, yeah, what. And also I think it's really important to think about the meld and flow of the seasons, because, yeah, it's not harsh.
It's not harsh like, no, spring, summer, autumn, no, winter. I think that's, no, what's nice about your book is you've got a kind of the bits where it crosses over and, yeah, you're still using a bit of spring and summer, yeah, and you're still using a bit of summer and,
yeah,
autumn.
I mean, at the moment, so, you know, again, we're mid-late Feb. The thing I'm doing kind of non-stop at home at the moment, yeah, is using the last of the blood oranges with the first of the purple sprouting broccoli. That is such a gorgeous combination. And for me, that partnership, mm-hmm, we talk so much about flavour partnerships in the book, that flavour partnership between the blood oranges and the purple sprouting broccoli is it. It's flavour-wise, it's it. And every time I do it, I feel, you know, sounds a bit over the top, but honestly, just the act of doing that makes me feel connected, yeah, with the rhythm of the seasons.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Samsung, Expedia, and Sephora. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Ah yes, the magnificent Trolley Sourbright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit Trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
Let's talk more specifically about the book. How did you decide which ingredients to focus on writing? And I'm quite interested in, were there any ingredients that you changed your mind about, as in you started off thinking, they're all right, and, yeah, by the end of writing the book, you were like, I'm a fan.
Yeah, for sure. It was hard to decide which ones to do. There's definitely scope for seasoning to more
ways.
Yeah,
I would say so. I know, and there's so many. I think there's, is there 50?
We've done about 50, yeah.
50 virgin fruit, yeah. And but then, yeah.
Like loads more, yeah, that we could do, and I really hope we do get the chance to. Yeah. I was very sad. I was particularly sad not to do green beans.
Okay.
I think that would be a great show, actually. Yeah. And there were a few things that I had to miss out because there were the ones that I loved, you know, really kind of going in, but also not just the ones that I loved, Janine, the ones that I really felt that people want to enjoy, but maybe things that we all slightly struggle to kind of really find different ways of using. So I wanted to kind of really probe into those ones like celeriac, you know, something which, you know, people think, oh, what am I going to do with that celeriac?
It's just looking at you with this big knobbly kind of
exactly skin. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of, you know, sort of not just do the ones that I loved, but to do the ones which I thought would be most, because, you know, this fundamentally came from a place of wanting to be useful, to be a kitchen companion for people to kind of grab and keep and keep going back to. So to kind of retain that usefulness, I was reaching for those vegetables and fruits. I'm going to fess up to not really being a lover of chard.
Okay.
I'm a bit more now, and I do say it in the book. I think it's, I don't know why I've not really, I've never really, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
But I think maybe beauty sort of scared me a bit. I didn't really know. It's like spinach, but it's not. It's like, what can I actually do with this? So I came at chard in a kind of, all right, show me what you got, chard, and let's see what we can do here. And then interestingly, I was on a walk with my publisher, happens to live really nearby, and we were going for a walk in our local park. And she's like, oh, I don't like chard either. So then my mission to become
it was like challenge chard.
It was. Oh my goodness, we should have called the section that. Darn it. My mission was, can I get Celine to feel fonder of chard than she did before? So I like to think we have both ended up in a happier chard place.
I love that. And what I love about the book as well is the introductions to the vegetables and fruit and meat and fish and dairy. They're so in depth. So I was fascinated to read, for example, celery, which I just buy without thinking because I, like you, use it as, you know, like mirepoix or, you know, sofrito. Used to be an autumn and winter luxury veg, which was prized by the upper and middle class Victorians. And they would have a special vase to show it off.
Sorry, Jean, do you not have a celery vase?
No. I'm going to get one. It's on the Christmas list.
But yeah, I mean, how nuts is that? How brilliant to think of something which we, and you're exactly right, and I say it in the book, take for granted.
Yeah.
Being so celebrated and being treated as, you know, a luxury and something to really kind of have of value. And I do, you know, I try in the introductions to each one of the profiles to give a little bit something which is either about the different varieties. So like for chard, you know, I go to the different kinds of chard and the overt oranges and things instead, you know, the difference, you know, Seville and blood and, you know, different kinds of stuff, but not always to be so technical about it, to tell a little bit of a story. Sometimes it's a personal story of mine about my own connection to that fruit or vegetable, like my husband not liking fennel, like there we are. And there are lots of things like that that make the book feel very personal. But when you can find an interesting story like that about the celery, I think it's lovely to kind of give people something, a moment of just saying, oh, goodness, maybe I could change slightly how I think about this thing.
And the other one which really struck with me because, it, again, guilty as charged, main crop potatoes. I just go Maris Piper, King Edward, they're the ones that I know and trust. And you were like, you're selling it so hard in your intro of like, you know, think about there are farmers out there who have, you know, balanced the soil to get the maximum flavour out and use a particular kind of potato. Yeah. And I just think of the potatoes and I'm like, I'm feeling guilty about it. You know, now I'm going to go off and see what else is out there and what difference it's going to make.
Well, I hope you don't feel too guilty. I hope you feel kind of inspired.
Yeah, inspired, I would say. Maybe inspired rather than guilty.
Just sort of people work really hard, you know, to make these things as good as they can be and to maximise things which we do take granted of what's in the soil, what's in the air. That's one of the things I love about potatoes, that, you know, where they're growing, the air that they're grown in can make such a difference.
Yeah, because I was thinking
about the coastal climate, the gentle winds.
Yeah.
And there's a romance to it. I mean, again, you know, talking about the romance of growing potatoes, I'm fully aware I'm starting to sound, you know, a little bit odd about it, but those things are real. And again, it's really part of what I wanted to kind of get across in the book of let's just all take a moment. Mm. And yes, you can whip through the book and you can find, okay, I could poach that or I could grill that or I could, cinnamon, that'd be lovely with that. Or sumac, that'd be lovely with that. But also just take a moment and think, how do I feel about this? How have our ancestors felt about this? How do the growers feel about this? Mm. How do other culinary cultures around the world feel about this? And just, to take a moment. It's hard to take a moment. And I'm a big fan of trying to encourage people, all of us, me, just to take a moment.
Yeah, that's great. As I mentioned before, you've included meat, fish and dairy and some notes on their seasonality. And people often don't think of these things as seasonal at all, say beyond something like spring lamb, which is a kind of a fallacy anyway, isn't it?
I know. And you're absolutely right that most people don't really think too much about the seasonality of, you know, meat, fish, dairy. And it really matters, again, in terms of sustainability. And it really matters in terms of our understanding of where our food comes from. And it really matters just in terms of joy. The pleasure. I really believe in the pleasure of looking forward to things, of having things, but also in sometimes not having things.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for missing stuff. You know, mackerel for me is a really good example of it, that it comes, you know, here in the UK, you know, late spring, right through the summer, and then ebbs off again. And I love that in the winter, that I'm, you know, fresh mackerel is just not going to be part of my food life. But, you know, I know that, you know, come late spring, summer, that's how I'm going to get my oily fish hitch, you know, yeah. Salmon. Increasingly, we're all getting, you know, more aware of how, yeah. you know, questionable at best salmon is. But lovely fresh mackerel, I enjoy it when we have it, because we should also know what, you know, we can't and we shouldn't have it all the time. Yeah. I say in the book too about, you know, spring and goat's cheeses, and that they taste different in the spring when they are young,
yeah.
And before they, you know, the dairy has been aged, but also when the pasture has certain flavour profiles to it. Things shouldn't necessarily be the same all year round. And the seasonality of vegetables and fruits, so, you know, people, even if they don't necessarily know the in-depthness of when something is in season, broadly speaking, any of us who are interested in food, you kind of know that the seasonality to the fresh produce of vegetables and fruits. Meat, fish, dairy, a little bit less so. And I just want to sort of look under the bonnet a little bit of that, because I do eat meat and fish. This is very much not a vegetarian book. Vegetables and fruits are absolutely at the forefront. But there are, you know, those are the things to do. And I think we need to have an eye as well as to how often and when we enjoy those things in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spoil anyone's Easter, but you do make a fair, a really fair point about really lamb should be, or is a bit more flavourful towards summer rather than eating it right at the beginning of spring.
Exactly.
Because you said it's not spring lamb, is it? No. It hasn't,
We're being sold this idea of a spring lamb, but mainly what we're getting is actually, you know, hogget, which is that bit older, in order for it to be of any decent size and indeed of any decent flavour. Does it matter whether you use the word lamb or hogget? For me, it's about people understanding what it is that they're buying, what it is that they're having. And also about, you know, the pressures that's put on farmers to have things, you know, at a certain time to fit the commercial market. I say, I'm not trying to ruin anyone's Easter. I'll be having sheep as well. It's just, it won't be lamb, it will be hogget.
Shall we talk a little bit in detail about one of the ingredients from the book that's in season right now? I've picked rhubarb because I feel like at the minute it's like the only fruit out there.
Yeah, I know
because
what you mean.
I'm having to, you know, when we get our seasonal, when we do our seasonal pages for Olive Magazine, for the magazine, I'm kind of going through and I'm constantly checking like seasonality of things. And there's a real massive gap. Like you mentioned, blood oranges are great, but there's a kind of big gap where you're not getting the citrus fruits, but you're not really getting any fruits beyond, say, cold store apples and pears and stuff. But then here comes gorgeous, bright pink forced rhubarb to save the day.
And I was so happy to write this section. So I had the absolute luxury, Janine, of writing the book in its seasons.
Did you?
I did, which was a bit of a fluke, to be honest.
Yeah.
But that was how it worked out. And that really made me feel much more emotionally connected.
Yeah, I was going to say connected
it.
To it.
I wasn't having to imagine, what do I think? I mean, obviously, because this is what I do. I keep food diaries and cook diaries of what I'm making all the year round. But I didn't have to imagine, how do I feel in February about what I want to eat? How do I feel about that forced rhubarb when it comes? I was able to sort of to live it. And I really hope that comes across in the book
so much that
my joy and connection with the food is very real.
Yeah.
And so when I say in the rhubarb, you know, think about that feeling of when it's all just a bit much, especially on daylight today, bit much. And these ridiculous sort of, you know, bright pink, bubblegum pink stalks of rhubarb, just like, they're like, hi. Yeah. It's going to be okay. Yeah. And you know, it's just joyous.
Yeah. And I was going to mention rhubarb in the context of how the book flows, as in you do an intro to the fruit or veg, and then you've got how to store it, ways to use it, and then flavour partners, and then how to preserve it. And I just love that, you know, before you even get to the recipes, I've got all of these tips about how I'm going to make the best of it.
I'm really, really happy that you feel that, because it was very important to me that this idea of doing a seasonal cookbook was much more than recipes.
Mm.
I wanted it to be a proper kitchen guide, a real companion. And so to do that, I wanted it to cover everything, as you've just said, from, you know, buy, store, ways to use, flavour partners, preserving, and then a couple of recipes that spring out of all of that. Mm. But if this is going to really be something which you can go back to in the kitchen again and again and again for a little bit of inspiration about how you might use something, you need to know those things of the different ways to use it, the different flavour partners you can put together. And then, because, you know, we do not want to waste things, a few ideas as to how you can preserve. So it was really important to me that each of the 50 vegetables and fruits comes with that absolutely comprehensive, why it's such a big book.
Yeah.
Comes with that really kind of comprehensive attack to it.
I think we chose the gorgeous looking rhubarb sponge pudding with creme fraiche.
Oh,
orange
lovely.
Blossom creme fraiche for the marg.
Yeah.
But then you've also got, flavour partners like rhubarb stem ginger.
Yeah.
Rhubarb goes with mackerel, as you said, one of your favourites before, with pork and lamb.
Yeah.
I mean, that's genius, but it cuts through the fattiness.
Yeah, yeah, it's so good, you know, with creamy desserts like rhubarb and custard,
you know,
one of the great ones. It's really kind of good with anything, you know, labneh, you know, mascarpone, anything kind of creamy. And so that applies to, you know, rich, you know, fatty meats as well. It just really can kind of cut through gorgeously. And that's something which I do a lot at this time of year because it gives a really lovely pep of flavour. Mm. One of my favourite flavour partnerships, it is in there, is about gin and rhubarb.
Nice.
And I sometimes do a little bit of gin in if I'm poaching rhubarb.
Oh, really?
And that's a really nice thing to do. And then you sort of take that thinking a bit further, Janine, and think, well, why do I like that? I like it because of the botanicals that are happening in the gin and doing something fun with the rhubarb. So let's break that down. So that's juniper, that's coriander seeds, that's lavender, that's rosemary, that's orange. So let's think about those flavour partners individually or in different combos, putting those with rhubarb. So it's layering into how you think about your flavours as well as the different techniques of what to do. One of my go-tos at the moment with rhubarb is to make a kind of a savoury rhubarb dressing, which is, you know, you just sort of poach it and then you blitz it up with some olive oil and then whatever you want of those flavour partners. And you can add in more oil or water or whatever you want, the consistency. And that is so lovely over some really lovely winter leaves. That is a gorgeous thing at this time of year, a real pep of flavour.
Yeah, and I love the fact that something my grandma used to grow in her garden and used to give us like little sticks of rhubarb dipped into white sugar.
That's in there. Did you clock that was in there?
I didn't see
It is. It's the very, very, you got it in front of you. It's the very last bit of ways to use.
Oh, amazing.
Is the idea.
She did. So she used to like call us in the kitchen. She'd give us a little bit of rhubarb. And dip it in sugar. I mean, it was white sugar, you know, but
that's okay.
It was the 70s.
Yes.
And I just remember eating it and that taste memory of the like puckering sour rhubarb with the sweet
but
sugar.
But kind of good.
Yeah, it was really good.
That's the thing you do it and you think,
that's really good.
Let's go back for another.
Yeah, I love that. I also wanted to just touch briefly on your waste tips because I found a tip in here that I was absolutely fascinated by, which is feta cheese. Don't throw away the brine from feta. Make a salad dressing out of it. Yeah. Like, how did you come up with
that? Have you done it yet?
No. Oh. I only read it yesterday. But I'm going to.
Let me know how it goes when you do it. The waste tips, so every recipe in the book, at the bottom of it has waste tips and things that you can then look at the back of the book and find ways to utilise some of the kind of byproducts of cooking.
Yeah.
So it's things like the brine in a block of feta, when you end up with spare egg whites, spare egg yolks.
Yeah.
One of my big ones, because I am an absolute anchovy fiend, is that, you know, the oil that's
the
left
oil,
behind.
Yeah.
And those things, otherwise it's so easy just to think, oh, well, that's my block of feta and I've drained it and I'm going to use the feta. Mm. And then this stuff that mainly is goes down the sink is so lovely and creamy and salty with kind of lactic edge to it.
Love it.
Great in dressings. Really good for cooking rice. Try that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really, really good.
So just add it to your rice cooking water.
Yeah, honestly, drop me a message and let me know how much you love it.
Oh, God, I love that idea.
And the anchovy oil, so rich in flavour, such a travesty to kind of get rid of it. Just keep it in the fridge and then next time you're doing something just, yeah, it's going to give a lovely little umami hit.
Wow. And do you feel like you learnt, I mean, you, I know that you said you keep a food diary, you know, you work in food. It's a big part of your job. Are you still learning? Did you learn a lot while writing this book?
I learned so much, so much. I had an absolute luxury of immersing myself in so many other people's work. The back of the book has a very extensive bibliography.
Yeah.
There's so much great work of modern food writers who, you know, you and everyone listening will know and love. But then also much older books as well. I was really able to immerse myself in so much. And I learned things I had no idea about, and ideas of flavours and ideas of ways of doing things,
yeah,
which were endlessly inspiring. And I was just so sad about how much I had to leave out.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot out there, but we've really kind of, you know, distilled it down into,
yeah,
some core things. But yeah, you can, there's some amazing things you, yeah, can discover, which I had such joy in discovering, and then such joy in passing on.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up by you telling us a few of your favourite recipes from the book. I know it's hard to choose between all of your children.
Does everyone go, oh, I, yeah, can't possibly,
yes,
come up with any favourites?
Yeah, they do.
But inevitably there are. Yeah, there are recipes in the book that are just a big part of my life.
Yeah.
And so they're favourites. There's a recipe for zarzuela, fennel and fish stew, which I make a lot at home.
Is that the one with the fennel in it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we kind of make the base and it sits there so you can make that ahead. It's a really good one if you've got people coming around. It's a really good one if you just, you know, want to then sit and have a nice drink or something. And then it's really quick, just add the fish and serve. So
gorgeous.
That's and the fennel has that, you know, bitterness to it,
yeah,
which then plays so gorgeously with the sweetness of the fish, whether you're using squid or hake or prawn. So you've got a lovely kind of flavour balance going,
yeah,
on. So that's one of my favourites, the zarzuela. Another one is the elderflower madeleines.
Oh, lovely.
I'm a lover madeleine.
Yeah.
Big fan of a madeleine.
Have you got the special tin?
Yeah. Not one, a bit of a film collection.
Madeleine tin habit.
Because I do love madeleine.
Yeah.
They have to be straight from the oven. Warm, lovely, kind of, you know, bouncy. Absolutely adore madeleines. So the elderflower madeleines in the book are made with elderflower cordial. So they appear in spring. And the elderflower cordial, as you can imagine, just gives a lovely,
gorgeous,
kind of floral lift. And I serve them, but they don't have to, with some gooseberries that are poached in gin.
Amazing.
Very, very nice. Indeed.
Tell us a bit again about that. I was speaking to you about one of the recipes I'd spotted, the lamb with the aubergine,
yeah,
cream, because you were saying this is a way that you cook quite often.
Oh, yeah. So this is lamb that with aubergines. And what you do is you slice the aubergines into circles of centimetres so thick, lay them on the roasting tin, and then you sit your lamb, hogget, mutton, on top of it. And it's been rubbed in, you know, spices,
yeah,
and sherry vinegar, I think, if memory serves. And then the lamb roasts on top of the aubergine pieces. And so you can imagine all the lovely, spicy, delicious lamb juices sink into these aubergines. And then you take the aubergines out and you blitz them up and they become a sauce. So what you've done is, and it's something which, you know, people will see happens a lot in my recipes,
yeah,
a lot in the writing in the book as well about flavour partnerships. It's a through line of flavour.
Mm.
That you have things which kind of adjust, they're sort of carrying the edges of each other's flavour characteristics with them. And it just, I always feel it kind of helps things feel part of a whole, that they're working,
yeah,
together in partnership. You know, that lamb and the aubergine sauce it ends up with have come from the same place. And then they go in different directions, but they're rooted in the same flavour place. And that gives them a sort of shared spirit when you're eating them.
Yeah, such a lovely way to cook. And
yeah,
I'm completely starving now. and it is such a beautiful book. And I love the feasting menus you suggest, which also, so there's a feasting menu. You put together different recipes in from the book, suggesting a menu. And then you've got tablescaping,
yeah,
ideas and,
yeah,
a cocktail to go with,
yeah,
it. I love this.
Because I think embracing the seasons,
yeah,
is about more than just the food.
Mm.
It's really about, it's a slightly holistic kind of way of living,
yeah,
I suppose. And so I feel it about the way you think about how you're going to use produce for drinks as well.
Yeah.
But also about, you know, decorating the table, which doesn't have to be some, you know, hugely extravagant thing.
Mm.
And I do mean, just like, I have a camellia, you know, bush in the garden at the moment. They're starting to come
They're gorgeous.
Take a head and, you know, lay it in a dish and just float a couple of camellia heads.
Yeah.
And your table is going to feel like you're in some sort of, you know, movie set.
Yeah.
And again, it's just that connection with what's happening around you. And it is about what you're cooking and eating, but it is also about how you can bring in those wider elements too.
Are you a big entertainer? Do you do a lot?
I do love having people around. That's when the Madeleines get served. Yeah. If you come around for supper, you're not allowed to leave until you've had a Madeleine.
I love it. So I believe the book is out on the 7th of March and it's called Season and How to Cook and Celebrate the Seasons. It's such a beautiful book, Angela. What else have you got coming up? I mean, obviously you're now got going into full on book promotion,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, I am. I've got a lovely book tour lined up.
Have you?
And I'm trying really hard to lean into enjoying this coming out.
Okay.
I'm a bit of a chaser. I'm always sort of what's next?
So this time you're just going
to... Trying really hard to just kind of sink into it. I put a lot into this book.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I'm madly proud of it and all the work that all the team have done to make it such a beauty. So I want to kind of really just kind of sink into getting this out there, enjoy it being out there.
Yeah.
And then
Where can people find out where you're touring? Is it on your Instagram?
That will be on my Insta. Cool. Yes, and on my website. But the Insta's, so it's Angela_Clutton. That be there, and kind of going to some lovely bookshops. It's brilliant. Independent bookshops are really getting behind the book, which is so nice.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thanks so much again for coming to chat to us. It's been amazing.
My absolute joy, Janine. Thank you.
That was the Olive Podcast. For more information, go to olivemagazine.com. And don't miss our Little Black Book bonus episodes, where guests give us their latest eating, drinking and travel tips, out every Wednesday.